Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, both of my guests today are journalists and authors with curious minds and a very quick wit, sense of humor. They both set out on separate one-year journeys. When Rachel Birchie first moved from New York to Chicago, she was thrilled to finally share a zip code, let alone an apartment with her boyfriend. But shortly after getting married, she realized that her new life was missing one thing, and that was friends. Especially best friends. She blends her story of 52 girl dates with her latest research on importance of friendship for a happy, healthy life. And I'll introduce her properly in just a moment. Coming up later in the show today, we'll talk with David Wallman. He began his journey by deciding to shun cash for an entire year. And with a couple of notable exceptions, he did succeed. He is the editor, contributing editor for Wired magazine, and during the tale of his 12-month odyssey, he explores the distinct possibility that cash will soon disappear altogether. He'll also share how cash penalizes the poor and how mobile technologies promise to change that, and why some people in America believe that the end of cash is actually the beginning of Armageddon. So we'll talk with David Wallman later in the show. First, I'm very pleased to welcome Rachel Birchie. She's a journalist and author living in Chicago. Her works appeared in Marie Claire, More, Teen, Vogue, Rachel Ray, Fitness, Women's Health, and CNN.com, to name just a few. Before leaving New York and her well-established BFFs, she was an editor at the Oprah magazine, and her new book is called MWF Seeking BFF, My Year-Long Search for a New Best Friend. Rachel Birchie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this was a really fun book. It was a really fun read. Made me look at my friendships and relationships differently to some extent. But so let's set this up for our listeners, Rachel. You lived in New York pretty much all of your life. You had these great BFFs, Sarah and Callie, since you were a kid. But you're in a long-distance relationship with this guy you're crazy about. Why move to Chicago?
Yeah, you know, I decided to move to Chicago because I was in a long-distance relationship, and I wanted to, you know, move forward and be in the same place as my boyfriend, who is now my husband. But I did, you know, I had to give up a lot, and the biggest thing that I had to give up was, I didn't have to give up my friends, but I had to give up that local friendship, that, you know, last-minute spontaneity where you can just say, what are you doing now? Let's go out to brunch. When I got to Chicago, I just didn't have those kinds of friendships. And I don't think I even realized how much I was leaving when I left New York behind, where so many of my best friends lived.
Yeah, and, you know, whether you move or not, we live in such a transient world today. I mean, just over the last 2 years, some of my very closest friends, in fact, all of my very closest friends have moved away. They've gone to Oregon and Florida and Hawaii and back to Europe. So I think this is something that affects many people today. And I'm sure you found that during the course of this year's journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, I thought at first, oh, I moved and that's why I found myself in this situation looking for new friendships. But as the year progressed and I've spoken to more women, I've realized that, you know, there are so many situations in which you can find yourself looking to make new friendships. Maybe you've moved, maybe your friends have moved. I've heard from women who, you know, got divorced and suddenly realized that they lost, you know, custody of some of their friends, or women who've retired and suddenly have all this new time on their hands. Mm-hmm. Women whose friends, you know, have gotten married and had kids and moved to the suburbs or they're in the city. So, you know, there are so many, there are different phases in our lives, but I think that this happens, but I think a lot of women, really all women I've spoken to, have can relate in some way to this kind of need for new local friendships.
Right. Right. Now, I guess I've been in relationships where my partner's been my best friend, where I've considered him my best friend,
right,
and vice versa. But you say you don't think that's possible.
Yeah, you know, I do say I don't think that your husband should be your BFF. I think they're two separate roles, or your boyfriend or your romantic partner, whoever it is. I think, you know, there's a lot when we think of our romantic partner as also our best friend and kind of our everything, that's putting a lot of pressure on one person. So I do think that you kind of need to share the love and not rely on one person to be everything for you. Because, you know, what happens if you break up? Then you're really in a tough spot.
You lose a lot.
And, you know, I always say, who am I? I can't complain to my husband about my husband. I need, you know, my friends for my girl talk and for that kind of emotional support. So I think it's important to kind of to share the roles. And it's, I really believe, so much better for a romantic relationship if you have other people. I think my husband and I, our relationship only improved when I suddenly, you know, had some women to do the whole girl talk thing with. I didn't rely on him for that. Suddenly, you know, we can kind of focus on what worked for us.
Right, right. And again, you know, it's what worked for you. Every couple is so different.
Right.
So you were about 27, I think, when you set out on this journey.
Right, I was. Yeah.
And what made you decide to devote a whole year to this? I mean, what came first, the book idea or the idea to do this, and then that led to the book?
Right. It sort of happened simultaneously, but first it was this project. I had lived in Chicago for 2.5 years, and I had been thinking about this nonstop because I just kept wondering, how am I going to make these friends? Because I had some friends that I could email, and after 2, you know, or 3 emails back and forth, we could set up a dinner date for 3 weeks later. But I wanted those kind of easy, come over tonight, let's drink some wine and watch some TV kind of friends. And I didn't have that after 2.5 years. And so I realized I needed to really, you know, they weren't going to show up on my doorstep. I had to go out and find them. And I'm someone who does like a project. I like a challenge. It makes it easier for me to kind of force myself to go out and do something. And I've always felt like a year, you know, in college, we used to say, you know, you need the first year is when you find your real friends. You know, at first you have maybe friends by default who live on your dorm room floor, for example.
Right.
And then eventually you sort of find your people. It can take a little while, so I didn't. And a year, in retrospect, is a pretty short time even to try to, you know, make a new best friend. There's some history involved in that relationship that you can't necessarily get in just a year. But anything shorter would have been hard. So I set myself this challenge to go on 52, you know, friend dates over the course of the year.
Right. And you're very honest in the book. You talk about, you know, sometimes you're embarrassed because you thought you sounded desperate or or you didn't know how to approach people. You know, how do I go up to somebody and, mm-hmm. you know, you can't go up and say, hey, do you want to be my new best friend?
Exactly. You know, there's a lot about looking for friendship that feels like dating, except for the fact that there aren't really kind of the established rules and protocol for how to go about doing it. So it can feel kind of tricky, and it can feel desperate because it's totally okay these days to say, you know, I'm looking for a man, I'm looking for love. It's a little bit harder and still a little bit kind of considered a little more pathetic, unfortunately, to say, oh, I'm looking for new friends. When you say I'm looking for a new friend, sometimes people hear, I have no friends, which isn't, you know, it's not
isn't
the same
true.
Thing.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You wanted that real connection and that,
right.
you know, hey, I need you kind of connection.
Exactly.
From time to time. So tell us about how you started out. How did you do? You went on this year-long journey, 52 dates, as you said. How did you decide to approach the first date?
Well, you know, I started out really kind of with the easiest thing I could think of, which was to reach out to my friends and ask to be set up. So again, sort of like dating. I said, I'm in Chicago. I'm looking for some new friends. If you know anyone, you know, introduce me, set us up. I'd love to meet them. So that was sort of I felt like that was kind of dipping my toe in the water of friending, as I call it. And then, you know, I wrote an essay that included a want ad, and it sort of said, you know, fluency in Entertainment Weekly, preferred but not required, and waited for people, you know, and I actually heard from a lot of people that way. And then I joined classes and signed up online for kind of friendship websites and did different groups, and then by the end of the year, I worked myself up to, you know, sort of the blind pickup, the giving my card to a woman on the plane or leaving a note for a waitress and saying to people, hey, you know, let's get lunch. But it's hard. It's scary to do that. I had to even when I set myself this challenge, I had to work up to those kind of big moments.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about how, because I moved to Washington State, 12, 13 years ago now, and I knew nobody when I came up here. And so I was thinking about how I met the people that I first became friends with and are still friends with today.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was a very strange, funny situation because I thought, I'll go to a writer's conference because, you know, I'm a writer, I'll meet other writers. And one of the presenters there came up to me and she goes, okay, this is going to sound really weird and I promise I'm not stalking you, because she'd walked by me about four times.
Right.
She said, but I'm married and this guy has asked me to go for lunch with him and I think he has other intentions. Would you mind joining us?
Oh, my gosh.
And we're still friends today, you know, 13 years later.
That's a great story. I've become really sort of, I've always been clearly fascinated with how people meet. But now I've, since my book came out about 2 months ago, I've been visiting a lot of book clubs that have read the book, and I love doing these author visits. And one of the most interesting parts for me is to hear about how the women in these book clubs met. The other day I was at one, and the girl who started the book club, basically everyone in the club had met because she had put a Craigslist ad out looking for roommates, and she found some, and then she went back to Craigslist and found some other roommates, and all these people basically were there because of Craigslist. And I went to another where the two women who started the book club met at the final Harry Potter film. They started talking about books and realized that they liked the same book, so they thought we should start a book club. So it's been really fun to hear other people's stories of how they met their BFF.
Yeah. And along with the I mean, you have a great sense of humor, and that comes across in the
Thank
book.
You.
So we'll talk about some of those stories when we come back from break.
Okay.
But I also want to talk about some of the science, because you studied a great deal of science on friendship and happiness and
yeah.
loneliness and all this. So I want to talk about some of that when we come back from break. My guest in this segment is Rachel Birchie, and her book is called MWF Seeking BFF, My Year-Long Search for a New Best Friend. Please stay with us, and when we come back, we'll continue with Rachel. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Well, I can't find my best friend to help me through this night. I can't find my best friend because she's somewhere out of sight. I miss her.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Open your ears, open your heart, open your mind. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Find my way, but I can't find my best friend. I suppose I'll find my way, but I can't find my best friend.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Rachel Birchie. She's a journalist and author. She's written a really funny but also informative new book called MWF Seeking BFF, My Year-Long Search for a New Best Friend. And in case you missed the beginning, Rachel moved to Chicago to be with her now husband and went in search of for a year in search of finding new best friends out there. So, Rachel, I wanted to talk because on your blog you have Research Wednesday, where you actually share research about the science of friendship and loneliness and all that's good with it. And you actually went to meet with a professor at one point. He made the statement to you that loneliness propels us forward, depression holds us back. So tell us a little bit about what you learned from your visit with him about friendship and loneliness.
Right. So he, as you said, he said, you know, loneliness propels us forward, because I felt very embarrassed to use the word lonely. I felt like there was a stigma, you know, and I didn't want to call myself lonely, because I didn't feel depressed. I didn't feel sad. I just was looking for new friends. And he said, you know, loneliness and depression aren't the same thing. And, you know, there is a stigma attached to loneliness right now, but you probably are lonely because you've been propelled forward. You've been kind of inspired to do this journey and make a change in your life to kind of get more connected and include more people, because you're sort of feeling lonely. And that really struck me, because I thought, okay, so it's okay to say I'm lonely. And I think we all sort of feel that way. We don't want to say we're looking for friends. We don't want people to think, oh, she's sitting at home crying all the time. You know, she has no friends. And that can be really tough. Another thing he told me that I thought was really interesting was this idea of sort of not to seem too desperate and too kind of clingy to new friends right away. You know, he mentioned that's a quick way to lose the new friends. You know, no one wants to feel so much pressure that a new friend is just wants to hang out with you every second of every day. It can feel like too much.
Right. Right. And that kind of sparked a memory of reading about somebody that you met via email, and she was about 60 miles away from you. And
right. You
go backwards and forwards by email several times, and then she dumps you on email, as you put it.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, you know, that happened. And I was sort of, a woman emailed me from my essay, from my want ad, and she felt, and it sort of felt kind of intense to me at first, because she said, we're not best friends yet, but let's pretend we are, and let's talk about all these things. And I thought, oh, God, I'm a little nervous about this. I felt the way that he said, you know, someone else might feel about me, like, whoa, let's slow down a little bit. This relationship is moving too fast. But in the end, she actually, before we ever met, emailed me and said, I think the distance is too much for us. I don't think we're going to be able to be best friends. Maybe we shouldn't meet. And I felt horrified, even though, as my husband pointed out, I was also a little hesitant about the distance. You know, it's hard to be spontaneous when you live 60 miles away. But, you know, the feeling of being dumped by, she wasn't even really a friend yet. And I've talked about this on my blog a lot, because breaking up with friends is such a loaded thing. And, you know, in my case, as I said, we hardly knew each other. And even then, it felt sort of horrifying and embarrassing and hurtful. But I've heard from women, you know, there is research out there that says that women feel more guilt when we break up with a friend than we do when we break up with a romantic partner.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really a touchy subject. And I think with, you know, romantic relationships, it's sort of not expected, but it's understood that you may break up.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of how relationships work. You either stay together forever or you break up, because you can't necessarily have a bunch at once.
Right.
With friends, you can have, in theory, as many friends as you want. So breaking up isn't really in the rule book. So it's really tricky, and we don't know what to do, and we don't know how to say things. And I'll hear from women all the time who say that, you know, the hardest breakup they've ever had in their life was a breakup with a friend, as opposed to a breakup with a romantic partner.
Have you ever been in that situation? Because I was thinking, and I have not, but I was betrayed by a couple of people over the years, as, you know, happens to most of us. And so I just kind of distanced myself. It was kind of passive-aggressive breakup, I guess.
Right. Well, I think that's more often what we do. I call it the slink away, where we sort of stop responding to emails or slow it down a little bit and stop reaching out and inviting, you know, someone to dinner. And it sort of, we let it fade, because the big confrontation is really hard and can feel like a little bit maybe melodramatic. Although I've heard from both sides, I've heard women who say, you know, being on the receiving end of the quote unquote slink away is really tough, because you don't know what you did or what happened, and suddenly someone isn't responding to you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard on both sides. My own memory of my worst friendship breakup is actually, you know, which speaks to this point, it's from eighth grade, when a girl sent me a letter while I was at summer camp and basically dumped me as a friend. She said she didn't want to be friends anymore. She thought I was a horrible person. And I just remember crying and crying for 2 days, because I was so hurt. And it still sticks with me to this day, you know, 20 years later. That's the friend breakup that kind of stuck with me.
Interesting. So you say, you mentioned the essay that you wrote, because you didn't want to put an ad on Craigslist.
Yeah, you know, if it were about 5 years ago, I might have been. Ever since the Craigslist killer, I'm a little more nervous about
that. I think a lot of people are. So you wrote this essay and you put an ad in the essay and you had a whole mixed bunch of responses from that.
Yeah. It's funny, when I wrote that, it never even really occurred to me that someone actually was going to respond, but I thought, why not? And I heard from so many women, most of which said, I feel like you're in my head. I feel the exact same way. I fit all your requirements, and let's get dinner. Let's be friends. But one of the most interesting things to me was that even though I was out there writing this essay saying I was looking for friends, still the women felt like they needed to kind of couch their email back in, I've never done this before. I've never emailed an author. I think this is crazy. I hope you don't think I seem desperate. And I thought, I'm not going to think you seem desperate. I'm the one who put the ad out for friends. But we all sort of are still kind of embarrassed by this.
Yeah.
But I made really wonderful friends that way. And I've made a lot of friends who I've introduced, that way, who were looking for friends. I introduced them, and now we've kind of turned into a group of friends.
Right. And I can relate to that because, I've never been somebody who read classified ads or anything. But one day I was working and I was looking through the Seattle Weekly for a project I was working on, a newspaper article. And I saw this ad for Women of Fun, and it just sounded inviting. And so I very cautiously phoned up about it, found out where they were meeting. And I thought, I'm just going to go and walk by. And if I like the look of them, I'll stop. And if I don't...
Right.
But I actually got one really good friend out of that I've had for 11 years now. But she's moved to Florida, so there you go.
Oh. Well, that's a sad ending, but it's true. You never know. And I think we all kind of have that same feeling, like, I don't do this normally. It seems strange.
Yeah.
But you just never know.
Now, as you started notching up the dates on your belt, your girl dates, you said you started looking reflecting on your strengths and weaknesses about yourself as a friend. What did you learn about yourself? I'm sure you learned an awful lot.
Yeah, I did. And I didn't even, I probably should have, but I didn't expect that to happen as much. And suddenly, if you go on enough friend dates, you sort of notice a pattern in your behavior. For example, I realized really quickly that I tend to interrupt people, which was kind of upsetting and horrifying to learn, but also, it's good to know. It's important to learn about yourself. And not only do I tend to interrupt, but sometimes I have those moments where I'll interrupt someone else's story with a story about myself, which is just like 101. It's probably not something that you want to do if you're trying to be a good listener. Not necessarily trying to one-up someone, but I say, someone will say, oh, I ran the marathon, and I'll say, oh, I ran a half marathon. Like, I'm trying to relate.
Right.
But, I learned as this happened that wasn't the way to relate, that the way is to listen and say, oh, I hear you. I understand what you're saying. That, that must have been hard for you. Or what was your training like? Asking questions and listening and making people want to feel heard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest things I learned during the year was how to be alone, which was very interesting to me because it was a whole quest about, connecting with other people. But suddenly, it used to be a case where I would hear about a class, and instead of signing up, that even if it sounded interesting, I would think, oh, I wish I had a friend to join and do this with. But instead, I kind of switched gears, and I started to think, oh, that sounds great. I'll sign up. Maybe I'll meet a friend there. Because suddenly you realize people with similar interests might also be in the same places. You'll make friends that way.
Yeah.
So I was able to kind of shift my thinking, which was great.
Yeah, interesting. I was up at the zoo in Canada, and I was watching a bunch of kids, and I was thinking how easily kids make friends, and we lose that as we grow older. And so I tried a little experiment myself. This was a couple of years ago, that when I ran into people, we'd maybe have a conversation on the beach if I met somebody with their dog, and then we'd just move off. So as we were just about to move off, I'd ask one more question. And I actually got two more friends from doing that. We found that we had a common bond, and just that one more question kind of led to that, which was really strange.
That's fascinating. It's interesting what you say about kids, because I've always been fascinated. Because with kids, they'll actually say, like, hi, you look nice, will you be my best friend? those things that we as adults think, oh my gosh, I could never do that. And it works. My husband, to this day, his best friend is someone he met, at day camp when he was 3 or 4, and he came home that day and said, I made a new best friend today. His name is Noah Benjamin. And here we are, 30 years later, basically.
Yeah, interesting.
So there's something about kids, they're they have a lot less judgment. They're not as reserved. They don't feel as vulnerable. So they're willing to say, will you be friends with me?
Right, right. And one more, I want to just go back to the health issue for a minute, because
yeah.
it's not the quality of friendships you found during the research, which surprised me. It was the quantity. When
right.
somebody's ill, that really surprised me. So
yeah,
talk about that a little, if you would.
People are always surprised. And, you know, I like to say, people say, oh, I think, you know, quality over quantity. And I say, you know, it's quality and quantity, or more is more when it comes to friendship, because the more friends you have, there's research that says, you know, people with at least 10 friends have better odds of survival, you know, years later. It really makes a difference. And if you think about it logically, you know, if I had only made one friend this year and then she moved, I'm sort of back to square one. So for me, I realized, you know, making more friends was really important, because I'm at a place where people are moving all the time, like you said. And if you only have one friend, you're sort of putting all your eggs in one basket, the same way with a romantic partner.
Mm.
But yeah, the research is out there. I mean, having a low level of social integration, they say, is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I mean, the health consequences are very serious and very real. And, you know, more friends, you know, you're more socially integrated, you have a bigger social network, and these things really correlate to your survival and your health and your happiness, less stress, better sleep, all those kind of things that we think about having a really healthy, long life. People kind of think, okay, I need to go to the doctor, I need to work out. I don't think we always think, oh, I need to socialize, I need to connect with people, but it's hugely important.
Right. So your journey finished a year long, sometimes exhausting, sometimes hilarious. What conclusions did you come to?
You know, my biggest conclusion was that, and this really surprised me, is that, you know, people are open to friendship. I thought going in that the big lesson would be people are closed off. We live in this mean, cruel world. And, you know, if you say I want to be friends, people are going to look at you like you have three heads. But I found the opposite to be true, that when I actually went out there and did the work and extended myself to people, they were actually quite receptive. We're all a little nervous to be the one to say, oh, will you be friends with me? Or, you know, I didn't say those words. I would say, oh, do you want to have lunch? You seem great. I think we could be friends. People were always said, oh, my God, that's so nice. I'd love to, because it's flattering to hear that someone likes us and
right.
wants to be friends with us.
So,
but I was really surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
And, yes, there were some mishaps and kind of hilarious adventures along the way. But in the end, what I found was that if you really do, it takes work. But if you do the work, people like friendship.
Right. So make the effort, get out of those fuzzy slippers and that bowl of Haagen-Dazs.
Yeah.
Get out there.
Exactly. That's what I had to do.
Well, I appreciate you being with us. It was certainly a fun book to read and certainly made me think about my friendships and relationships. The book is called MWF Seeking BFF, My Year-Long Search for a New Best Friend. And you can find out more about Rachel Birchie at MWFSeekingBFF.com. Rachel Birchie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And please do stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be joined by David Wollman. Again, he went on a year-long journey. His book is called The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming of Cashless Society. Please do stay with us.
No one told you that was gonna be this way. Your job's a joke, you broke, your life's the only way.
Taking care of thousands of animals every year is no walk in the park, but a walk in the park will help save thousands more. Join PAWS this year for the 21st annual PAWS Walk at Merrymore Park in Redmond on September 8th. But the walk is just the start. You can try the latest pet products at our doggy mall, run the canine agility course, or visit the PAWS Kids Zone. You can even grab a pint of ale in the Pooch Pub. Put your team together today by registering at pawswalk.net. Or for more information, just go to paws.org. Paws, people helping animals, and vice versa.
OMG, grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Join us September 10th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Tal Ben-Shahar taught the most popular Harvard course in its history. He joins Vicki to share a life-changing lesson built from years of teaching around the world, talking with thousands of people, and coupled with the very latest psychology research. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific time for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on Alternative Talk 1150. See conversationslive.net for more information and show schedules.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, today's show is all about two great writers and authors who both went on year-long separate journeys. And my second guest today is David Woolman. He's a contributing editor at Wired. He's written for such publications as Outside, Mother Jones, Newsweek, Discover, Forbes, and Salon. And his work has appeared in Best American Science Writing 2009. He's a former Fulbright Journalism Fellow, which he did in Japan, and a graduate of Stanford University's journalism program, and he now lives in Portland, Oregon, where he received a 2011 Oregon Arts Commission Individual Artist Fellowship. He's written a couple of previous books, A Left-Hand Turn Around the World and Writing the Mother Tongue, and his new book is called The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming of Cashless Society. David Woolman, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, I wanted to start with a little history, if we can, because I was interested. Well, let's start with your essay with Wired, because you wrote an essay for Wired, and you declared that physical currency is a bulky, germ-smeared, carbon-intensive, expensive medium of exchange. Let's dump it. And you had an overwhelming reader response, which was what?
Which was angry. it was angry from a number of different angles. And, you know, you had sort of people with from the ACLU side of things, caps lock, bold, underline, how dare you suggest that we should subject our financial lives to the scrutiny of banks and credit card companies even more so than the present. And I had sort of the militiamen set saying, you'll have to pry my cash from my cold, dead hands. I had, you know, plenty of tax evaders who wrote in code basically saying this would be problematic for me and my finances. there were a lot of concerns, you know, some off the wall and wacky, some totally legitimate. And yet what I realized with this project, you know, at first I threw that out there, that essay in Wired in 2009, you know, just looking, our movies, our music, our books, so many things are moving to the digital realm. Cash, as in rectangular slips of paper and little coins, you know, this is a technology, and it's a technology that has not changed in a very long time. And so because we've sort of pushed cash to the periphery of our everyday lives to such a great extent already, I thought, well, maybe, you know, this stuff is actually kind of expensive. What would it be like to get rid of it? So I threw it out there. The response was so overwhelming and, yes, vitriolic at times that I figured, well, this would be a great book project.
Right. Now, I didn't know until I read your book that the Chinese were the ones who came up with the first paper money. Tell us a little bit about the history of money.
Sure. Well, and, you know, the first section of the book is devoted to sort of the history and how we got here from there. And for eons, you know, people were trading goods and services just fine without a quote-unquote medium of exchange, right? And this was barter, or sort of souped-up forms of barter. You have some extra furs, I have a surplus of potatoes, and we happen to have the double coincidence of wants. That is, I want some furs and you want some potatoes, and so there, we trade. That's great, but things get a little more complicated when you don't want exactly the item or services I have, but you want something from someone else. money as an invention, you know, that you could have this intermediary medium of exchange, this thing that would store value, serve that purpose. You know, this is a remarkable invention, and you know, we spend a lot of our time, rightfully so, sort of griping about money and the stress it creates and debt and the federal debt and unscrupulous bankers and the like, but money is an incredible sort of civilization-powering innovation, and so it was something I wanted to touch on early in the book. Then we fast forward a little bit to the evolution of banknotes, and the first banknotes, as you mentioned, appeared in China. So the idea is that there were coins in China. In this case, I think things were copper at the time, but gold, copper, silver, it doesn't really matter. So this was the medium of exchange. The item itself had this value. It would store whatever worth, and you could transact with that. Then people realized, well, you could actually just put that in a vault or a metaphorical vault somewhere and circulate pieces of paper representing that metal or that material in the vault, right? And so that's where the Ming banknotes emerge as the first paper money in the world. And then, of course, the problem that the Chinese then ran into and that many governments have since is the temptation to issue more paper than, you know, just the amount of paper that would have the kind of one-to-one correspondence with what you're circulating and what's in your vault. And I don't say that in any conspiratorial sense of things, but that is how inflation and even hyperinflation happens, right? Because if way too much paper is zooming around, then suddenly it doesn't have much scarcity. And why should I value a bag full of maple leaves when they're just falling everywhere from the sky?
Right. So you share a lot of history. You share a lot of facts in here. One of the things that surprised me when I was reading an article that you'd written was that there are some resorts, and I did further research on it, and there were quite a few nightclubs and places like that in Europe where people can actually get a microchip put under their skin and charge their bills that way. That shocked me.
And I, you know, to be honest, I think both the merchants who provide this quote-unquote service and the consumers who utilize it, I think they want you to feel shocked by it. I mean, it just has shock value written all over it, and if it doesn't drum up, anxieties about a lack of privacy broadly, then certainly, you know, concerns about Big Brother and the like, they're legitimate. And one of the characters I speak to early in the book is a pastor in Georgia who feels that, you know, going cashless is one of the, you know, the final steps toward welcoming the Antichrist back here to Earth. And, you know, he's really scared by these technologies. And I think the first resort to offer this was in Spain, if I'm not mistaken.
That's
and the idea there being, you know, if you're just wearing a thong bikini at a resort somewhere, it's pretty inconvenient to carry your wallet around also. And this might be a good way to, you know, to reduce the friction in the economic lives of patrons at this resort, i.e. they'll buy more drinks at the bar if they can just have a chip implanted in their arm.
Well, I went to a camp once in Morocco where they gave you bought a string of beads and the beads were worth so much. I think that's a better way for me to go rather than having an implant put in.
Right. And, you know, these different forms of money, they cast their own sort of different kind of spell on us. And there's a section in the book about psychology and behavioral economics, right? Because we treat different forms of money differently. And even though you were just joking about the beaded necklace there, in fact, you know, how we treat $100 in our wallet in paper form versus credit money on a credit card versus $100 in our savings account versus on, you know, the beads that represent $100. We actually spend it and save it quite differently. And economists kind of categorize it as all the same kind of money. But anyone will tell you, anyone who has ever been felt a little reluctant about breaking a $100 bill will tell you that, you know, 5 20s may equal 100 mathematically, but to the consumer, to the public, a $100 bill is, you know, has this kind of special aura to it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about anonymity versus you say we don't really want anonymity. What we want really is privacy, because that's a very big concern with digital technology. I also want to take a look at some of the places, because you went around the globe trying to piece together a cross-cultural picture of cash today. And so we'll talk about that when we come back from the break, so I don't have to interrupt you on that, David. My guest is David Wolman in this segment, and his book is called The End of Money. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay tuned.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Join us September 10th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Tal Ben-Shahar taught the most popular Harvard course in its history. He joins Vicki to share a life-changing lesson built from years of teaching around the world, talking with thousands of people, and coupled with the very latest psychology research. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific time for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on Alternative Talk 1150. See conversationslive.net for more information and show schedules.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I guess after talking in the break, I'm going to have to talk really quick because we've got loads of information to get through. But Eric was just saying, our producer in the break, that in Iceland at the Blue Lagoon, they give you a blue wristband for...
Yeah, they give you a waterproof wristband that has the microchip in it. So you can swipe that at the bar and buy all your drinks. And then it's charged to your credit card. So this way you can go in the water in your shorts. You don't have to have... you know, a pocket
right.
full of cash or your credit cards, whatever.
Right, right.
Just seems better than getting an implant to me.
And David Wollman is my guest. His new book is really interesting. It's about his journey across the globe looking for cashless society. And it's called The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. Well, this book is packed so full of information, we can't possibly do justice to it at all, David. You talked with people from all over the world. But I wanted to touch a little bit on, you went to Iceland too, so tell us what you found in Iceland that was so interesting.
Sure. Well, not long after Iceland's economic collapse, which you may recall, this was the biggest banking failure in the history of humanity a couple of years ago. People in Iceland were talking about their national currency and its fate, and although it sounds ridiculous at the moment, they were thinking about dumping the national currency to go on the euro, and I say that little side note, because as we know, the euro is causing all kinds of trouble now.
Right,
but in
right.
any case, the fate of the krona is sort of hanging in the balance. So I wanted to go over there and explore, you know, do a sort of postmortem on the financial crisis and the fate of the krona, but from this specific vantage point of cash and physical money, right? Because physical banknotes and coins, it's like one of the last tactile touchstones of our national identities. And, you know, some people, going back to my earlier mention of all the people who came out swinging when I suggested this thesis of getting rid of cash, you know, some people said getting rid of greenbacks is like, you know, burning the flag on the mall in Washington. And, you know, these are very nationalistic, patriotic symbols, symbology. I mean, you can sort of, I'm sure there's plenty of dissertations out there on this stuff. And so I flew to Iceland to interview the woman who designed Iceland's banknotes, to talk to her a little bit about this idea of heritage you can hold in your hand, and what is the relationship between being from a country and the paper money that circulates in that place. And of course, you know, as is often the case with travel, or at least for me, you know, being over there, being someplace far away, catalyzes reflection about life at home. And in this case, you know, the almighty dollar and what is arguably, you know, the most instantly recognizable imagery in the world to anybody, you know, Ben Franklin's pimply visage on a $100 bill, for example.
Right, right. Now, you, throughout the course of this year, you tried to live as cashless as possible. Tell us how you did on that, and then I want to talk about India, because I think that's really interesting.
Sure. Sure. So going cashless for a year, this was my way to kind of keep this this meditation running on a daily basis, even if I wasn't heavily into reporting that day or running errands with my toddler. You know, I'm still thinking about money and its and physical money and its place in our lives, as I would. You know, I seem to have become much more attentive about armored truck vehicles, you know, polluting out there on our highways. And the circa 1982 ATM machine down the street from me here in Portland, Oregon, that, you know, is covered in graffiti and just looks ridiculous. It looks so old-fashioned. And you know, the barista who is handling paper money and then heading off to make my latte, and I'm thinking, you know, washing your hands right about now would have been nice.
Right.
But so going cashless, this was the idea, right? It wasn't going to make for gripping narrative for the bulk of the project, you know, in the way that a much, like a super gutsy participatory journalism piece would be, like George Plimpton lining up as the quarterback for the Detroit Lions or something like that. So that wasn't the goal. But what happened was, living cashlessly was not so hard right up until those moments when it was totally impossible. And a few included trying to hop a train into Manhattan, of all places. I wasn't able to buy a ticket in advance. It was a last-minute trip. And you can't pay for your ticket on the New Jersey Transit train bound for the economic center of the universe if you don't have paper and metal coins. And then, of course, when I went to India, you know, then it takes a much more serious turn in the book, because I'm reporting on sort of cash's role as kind of the enemy of the poor, and cash is actually punitive costs on the poor. And in developing countries, a lot of international aid groups are trying to get people using their phones more for transactions instead of cash because of these problems of cash's costs. And so I flew to India to do some of that reporting, and really, before the wheels of the plane hit the ground, I realized, you know, holy cow, this cashless year has got to go on pause for a little while. If I want to do anything in India outside of my hotel, I'm going to have to get cash, you know, to pay my translator, to buy a taxi, to eat on the street, to visit a historical site, all of it, and then some, even to buy minutes for my mobile phone, coincidentally, which, of course, was sort of the theme of the topic. I was going to need cash, and that sort of, you know, was a sudden wake-up call to sort of how essential cash is still in a lot of developing economies, and yet was also a useful window into this wider conversation of, can we get past cash in those places where it is so punitive?
Yeah. And yet in India, you found that they were using the technology more. And there's a whole movement I read in your book by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation looking into this. Because somebody called Mas who said that cash keeps the poor.
Right. So the idea is that, you know, it's just counterintuitive, right? Cash is the enemy of the poor. How could that be so? Cash is money. Everybody needs money. Okay, we get that. And the idea here is that different forms of money have different costs. And for you and me, Vicky, we can sort of toggle at will between electronic money and cash. And there isn't too much of a cost, too much of an inconvenience in our lives about it. I would argue that, you know, you're wasting your time and energy and your valuable time and energy to head to the ATM to get $50 to pay your half of a dinner bill tonight. But if you want to do that, that's your beef. But for the poor, they have no option, right? So they are trapped using cash. And what that means is that they don't have the ability to save that you and I have, to save in the boring banking sense of saving. And, you know, I imagine you don't get paid in cash anymore. You don't pay your rent or your mortgage mm-hmm. in cash. These are all the ways that you've decided that electronic money is better for you than physical money, even though you've never thought of it that way, you know, let alone buying a sofa or a new sweater. And for the poor, because they're stuck in cash, they don't have that safe and secure way to store their wealth, however little or however much they have. You know, and again, in the old-fashioned sense of banking, this is not you know, a Valentine to bankers or credit card companies, let alone collateralized debt obligations and all of that other banking sector craziness. It's just the simple idea of a safe and secure way to store your wealth and to build up savings, because when you're stuck using cash, everybody is making claims on it all the time, right? So your drunk uncle or your abusive spouse or a neighbor down the street who really needs a new tire for his moped to get to work, that's a pretty legitimate request right there for the moped tire. The problem is you're trying to buy farm equipment or just trying to save up to buy some farm equipment or to send your daughter to school in 10 months. You know, the kind of investments that help you actually climb out of poverty permanently, not just for a week. And so without access to saving tools, you can't really do that well. And cash and being locked using cash, locked into the cash economy, actually is a real obstacle to accessing those financial services.
Yeah, interesting. What else? I mean, you look in the book at alternative currencies, and I have to confess my ignorance here because I was watching a program called The Good Wife a couple of weeks ago, and they talked about this. One of the cases was the Bitcoin, and are they impinging upon, you know, our currency? And I thought it was a made-up thing until I Googled it and realized it was the Bitcoin. The Bitcoin is a legitimate form of currency right now.
Exactly. So there's a whole section of the book that is looking at these questions of alternative currencies, community currencies, virtual currencies. And, you know, in a way, one way to think of it is death is undergoing this death by a thousand cuts, right? So on the left side, you're seeing all these technologies and easier ways to pay using your phone, et cetera. And I don't know if we're at cut number 890 or 952, but it's happening. Another category of cuts, I think, is coming from these alternative currency innovators. And Bitcoin that you mentioned is another one. And people now are saying, you know, why do we necessarily give government a monopoly on issuing currency? Because there's nothing illegal about using some other form of currency as long as you're not counterfeiting U.S. dollars or some other national currency. And, you know, this circles back to the idea of, like, well, what is money? What is value? What is a currency? When, in fact, absolutely anything you want it to be could be money. It's just an idea because, you know, the dollar is not connected to some specific amount of gold dug up in from a mine in South Africa anywhere. It's just a dollar is a dollar because we believe that the United States government will meet its obligations. And that might make a lot of people roll their eyes, and it makes it sound like it's all pixie dust, but that's it. And so with that in mind, a lot of people are saying, well, maybe the U.S. government is not the greatest steward of the currency it is providing us with, it is issuing for us to use. And so I wanted to explore that thread in the book. And there are some, you know, I met with some interesting characters who are behind some of these alternative currency ideas. And, you know, they strike a lot of people as kind of kooky on the surface, in large part because the dollar has had such profound success, you know, kind of conquering the world, and it's universally accepted, et cetera. But there's nothing illegitimate about these other currencies. The rub is you've got to get people transacting with them and trusting them.
Right.
And that's, you know, Bitcoin has a lot of enthusiasts, but it also has a lot of critics. It also has a lot of people worried about counterfeiting in the digital realm. But, you know, what I like about it more broadly is it gets people so interested in, or at least a little more curious about, A, what money actually is, and B, you know, how does currency work? And then maybe C, boy, the physical stuff really is outdated.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you being with us today. Really great read. A lot of research went into this. The book is called The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming of Cashless Society. David Wellman, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And listeners, you can find out more about David's work and the book at david-wolman.com. And Wolman is W-O-L-M-A-N, david-wolman.com. I do thank you for being with us today. Appreciate your time. And we'll be back next week with a brand new show. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Join us September 10th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Tal Ben-Shahar taught the most popular Harvard course in its history. He joins Vicki to share a life-changing lesson built from years of teaching around the world, talking with thousands of people, and coupled with the very latest psychology research. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific time for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair on Alternative Talk 1150. See conversationslive.net for more information and show schedules.